Genomics, and Integrative Biology in New Delhi. Srinath Reddy, an epidemiologist and head of the Public Health Foundation of India in New Delhi, argues that people letting their guards down is a bigger driver. The pandemic resurfaced in a fully open society where people were mixing and moving and traveling, he says. With cases declining after last September's peak, there was a public narrative that India had conquered COVID-19, says Lamisarian. In recent months, large crowds have gathered indoors and outdoors for rallies, celebrations, and weddings. The nationwide vaccination campaign, which kicked off in January, might even have contributed to an uptick in cases if it caused people to ease public health measures. The arrival of the vaccine put everyone into a relaxed mood, says Lamisarian. More than 120 million doses have been administered, mostly of Indian-produced version of Oxford vaccine called Covishield, but that's less than 10% of India's population, so there is still a long way to go. In particular, India needs to ramp up vaccinations in the hardest hit region, says Kang. Some people might have become infected while getting vaccines, says Onavia, because crowds often share clinic waiting areas with ill people who are waiting to be seen.
Around the world with reporters.
For the fifth consecutive day, India has recorded an overwhelming number of COVID-19 infections. The country lodged around 350,000 fresh cases and about 2,700 deaths, raising fears of further devastation and dismay among its citizens. Many experts say the numbers are underestimations and that the real figures are likely to be much higher than the government figures. By Sunday, the number of total cases in the world's second most populous nation stood at 17 million with over 192,000 deaths.
India is witnessing scenes of utter mayhem amid new wave of the outbreak. The hospitals have been overwhelmed and are turning away patients due to lack of beds and oxygen supplies, revealing the vulnerability of India's healthcare system.
Many Indian states have now imposed more stringent restrictions on people's movement. Here in the capital, New Delhi, the lockdown has been extended for one more week as the cases are soaring rapidly. According to some estimations, more than 300 people are infected with COVID-19 every minute across the country. A few months ago, India seemed to be doing remarkably well in handling the COVID crisis, but experts say election campaigns, gatherings, and opening up of markets and public spaces aggravated the situation.
What we see on the TV about government data on deaths or infection is nothing but just a glimpse of actual numbers. Many cases are not even being reported, nor the calculations are accurate. This is not a pandemic. This is the sign of the judgment day. We don't even have a calculation of how many we cremate each day.
In his latest radio telecast, Prime Minister Narendra Modi urged the nation not to fall prey to rumors and assured that the free vaccination program will continue in full swing. The Indian leaders said this storm has shaken the country. Leaders from across the globe have expressed their concern and extended support in every possible way. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Senior officials from all signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are in the Austrian capital, Vienna, discussing ways to revive the ailing accord. 3 weeks on, there's no tangible progress in the discussions. Iran's top negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, said if Iran feels the other parties are trying to buy time, Tehran will leave the talks.
We are not here to waste our time. We are not here to negotiate for negotiations. We are here to specify and identify the sanctions which should be lifted by the U.S.
In his weekly briefing, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, said there will be no agreement without an all-inclusive agreement.
We are not interested in lengthy talks, but we are also not in rush. The only principle that we are following is to fulfill all the benefits that Iran is supposed to get out of the JCPOA. Anything less than a wholesale, verifiable, and a single step removal of all sanctions is not accepted by Tehran.
The Vienna talks have so far failed to lead to concrete results. The major sticking point is the fact that the U.S. insists on pushing its own narrative, pressing for a step-for-step removal of the sanctions. Tehran has categorically rejected such a plan in the first place, saying Washington needs to verifiably remove all sanctions before Iran returns to full compliance.
All the sanctions, including those who have been imposed, reimposed, or relabeled, should be removed. The domestic politics of the United States is not our concern. In international relations and international law, governments are sole responsible bodies to fulfill the commitments of the states when they make.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. As a tit-for-tat, Iran reduced its own commitments by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, above the 3.6% cap set by the deal. As the Vienna discussions are becoming sluggish, Tehran says there's no need for prolonged negotiations. Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must lift all anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Period. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Many artists across the world have turned to art to show the suffering of the Palestinian people. They use art as a medium of expression against the Israeli regime's repressive policies. Iran's Art Bureau of the Islamic Ideology Dissemination Organization is currently holding an exhibition and competition called Palestine is Not Alone. Hundreds of works by different artists from many countries are displayed at this international cartoon and poster contest, which is held to show solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine.
We received around 2,500 works from 66 countries. Salient figures sent cartoons, caricatures, and posters to participate in the contest. It shows that there are many artists across the globe who want to support the oppressed people of Palestine and stand against the oppressor.
Today's war has a new form. It is more staged in the media. Art as a medium is now playing an important role in wars. There are many people who do not want to comment directly on war. Therefore, they prefer artistic ways to express themselves.
I Free You Palestine and Lullaby were two poems by Atefe Sadat Darbandi, which were later turned into a video clip. The clips have been screened on Press TV and welcomed by the audience.
I was feeling sad when seeing the photos of the Palestinian kids who were suffering in conflicts, so I wrote an English poem called Lullaby for these kids. It is a story of the parents who are singing lullaby for their babies, asking them to keep calm because all these difficulties may pass. A colleague of mine composed its music and sang the song. Then we turned it into a video clip to be aired on TV.
The issue of Palestine is one of the major topics these days when deals are being formed between some Arab states and Israel to normalize ties. But artists from these countries oppose such relations.
Resistance art reflects how the Palestinians suffered under occupation for over 50 years. Art is a great way of expression and helps the artists to show their first-hand experiences. Human Abedi, Tehran.
The Palestinian Authority, along with different political factions, held Israel fully responsible for the serious deterioration in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds over the past few days and called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its provocations. Israeli police and settler violence erupted in the area on Thursday night and continued through Friday, leaving over 100 of Palestinians wounded and scores more arrested.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, Israeli forces had been escalating measures against the people there, starting by cutting off loudspeakers of Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's why our people in Al-Quds are protesting and rising against oppression and crimes by the Israeli regime.
But the issue is not only between the Israeli police and the Palestinians. Since the start of the holy month of Ramadan, every night hundreds of Israeli settlers rush to the streets of the holy city and assault Palestinians under the protection of the Israeli forces. The extremist settlers chant death to Arabs during their marches. Hundreds of ultra-nationalist Israelis marched through central Jerusalem towards the Damascus Gate, which police had barricaded as a precaution.
Verbal condemnation of Israel over the aggression is not enough. The Palestinian factions must offer all forms of support to Al-Quds and its residents. Palestinians must stand united behind Al-Quds. What's going on is an uprising, and here in occupied West Bank, protests and demonstrations should continue. This is the least we can do to defend Al-Quds.
Palestinians say Israeli police want to prevent them from saying their prayers and the usual Ramadan evening gatherings at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and outside the Damascus Gate.
Protests which flared up in Jerusalem Al-Quds have now spilled over to the occupied West Bank in defense of the Holy City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians warned that Tel Aviv is heading towards a heavy-handed crackdown against them in the occupied territories to ward off another surge in Palestinians' protests and anger. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Nowadays, Afghan security and military forces are witnessing the last months of the presence of their US-led NATO allies. These forces are determined to protect their country against any threats on their own without any outside help. As top military officials here say, the Afghan armed forces will overcome any challenges after the pullout of foreign troops by drawing on the experience they have gained in fighting terrorism over the past two decades.
Currently, US-led NATO forces are stationed in their bases only in Bagram and Balkh provinces, but they will leave these key bases too. We won't be worried about this because our forces have, over the past two decades, gained enough experience on how to counter terrorists.
Confirming that Afghan military and security forces are still in need of financial support, the Afghan government says the good news is that foreign forces will hand over military hardware to the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country by September 11th.
Based on our negotiations with foreign military officials, they will hand over weapons and other military equipment worth $1 billion to Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country.
According to experts here, because the Afghan National Armed Forces are popular among locals, Afghan people are expected to stand by these troops and support any possible scenario that might unfold after the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. Still, they urge both the Afghan government and the Taliban to set aside their differences and use the Afghan peace process as a great opportunity to put an end to the decades-long misery of the war-weary nation.
Unfortunately, we have gained nothing from peace summits over the past 2 years. Instead, war in the country has intensified. I think it is high time that both sides forgot about military options, set aside their differences, and launched meaningful negotiations to end the war here.
Top Afghan security officials say they stand ready to safeguard the nation in case the Taliban continue to insist on saying no to negotiations.
According to the head of Afghanistan's National Directorate of Security, the Taliban is now weaker than ever due to alleged rifts between the militant group's main leadership in Quetta Shura and its offshoot in Pakistan's Peshawar. This is thought to be a major stumbling block if the militants seek to put up a fight against some 300,000 Afghan security and defense forces after the withdrawal of nearly 10,000 foreign troops from Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Indian-administered Kashmir has seen a surge in coronavirus cases in times with the rest of the country. The pandemic was almost brought under control in February in the region, but within weeks, the numbers have swollen again to around 18,000 positive cases. Healthcare experts equally blame Kashmir's administration and locals for the spike. Despite the risks, the administration in Kashmir allowed and organized spring festivals. They were attended by thousands without following precautions, leading to a resurge in coronavirus cases. And to worsen things, tourists' inflow to Kashmir went unchecked. Kashmir has hardly witnessed normalcy since August 2019, when India unilaterally stripped the region of its autonomous status. Now, amid the second wave of the pandemic, fresh tensions are expected as new lockdowns would collapse the region's economy. Farooq Ahmed Shah, a hotelier, is discussing the ongoing situation with his staff. He is worried, but not for himself.
We have witnessed back-to-back lockdowns. Unfortunately, we do hiring every year, but with no time, we have to lay off. I'm not much worried about my business. But for these young men who have no source of daily income or savings that can sustain them in tough times, Kashmir's economy has always been suffering. But since 2019, Kashmir is witnessing horrible times and people are forced into poverty.
Kashmir's economy is dependent on tourism and agriculture. This year, the region witnessed year-long bookings in advance. However, the new wave of the pandemic in India has triggered panic and cancellations.
The pandemic since 2020 has 100% affected us, but you know, from November, the tourism started reviving, and December mid onwards, it was getting better, and from January, Kashmir was 100%, almost 100% packed, if not 100, but 80% for sure. So since March ending, you know, due to the surge in cases across country, the tourism is coming down again. It is a huge loss for the industry.
However, Shamim and many others like him are more worried for Kashmir's health infrastructure. They fear a looming disaster if the coronavirus situation is not taken seriously.
With more than 18,000 active coronavirus cases in Jammu and Kashmir, the administration of this conflict-torn region is at a crossroads. The question is whether to impose a lockdown and face its economic consequences or endanger people and overload the fractured health sector. To break the chain of infections, the administration is trying its best. However, the people also have to act responsibly. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Coviran is inching closer to the market. The Iranian-made vaccine kick-started the third human trial phase after proving safe and effective against the virus in previous trials. The third phase will involve injecting the jabs to a statistical population of 20,000 volunteers. Developers say they're certain that the vaccine provides immunity of up to 70% against the coronavirus. But it's only after the third phase that an accurate figure can be achieved.
Already we have achieved the figures, but because we want to have more figures, so in third clinical trial stage, you have to go for more, you know, people to vaccinate. And that's why in third phase, we include more people, like 20,000 in compared with 200 or 280 in second phase.
The headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, which is in charge of Coviran's development, says it has already launched the production lines of the vaccines due to emergency.
Coviran factories are built in two phases. The first phase, which is complete and ready for use, has a capacity to produce up to 3.5 billion doses of Coviran jabs each month. The second phase, which is under construction, will produce 15 million doses per month. Both will work in full swing once we receive the necessary permits in almost 2 months.
Coviran works based on an inactivated coronavirus. Its developers say lab results indicate that it's also effective against new variants of the virus. Other than Coviran, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, each based on a different platform to immunize the human body against COVID-19. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V. Once the third phase is over, Coviran will be the first ever Iranian-made COVID vaccine that makes its way to the market. This as Iran is grappling with the fourth and most lethal ever wave of the pandemic, which has put biotech firms in a race against time to get their jabs to the mass production stage. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
While many in America are celebrating an extremely rare murder conviction for a police officer for the killing of George Floyd, demands for police reform are only growing louder. Police in the United States kill about 1,000 people every year, so there's no chance the issue will go away. This month in Chicago, the nation's third largest but deadliest city, a 13-year-old boy was killed by police even though he clearly had his hands up in surrender. Eliminating systemic racism in law enforcement and implementing criminal justice reform is being demanded in the streets and in newspaper headlines, but tax money continues to be invested in more guns and war materiel. The combined spending of America's state and local budgets on police would rank as the world's third largest military expenditure. Last year, the city of Chicago received $500 million in discretionary spending from the first major federal stimulus package. $300 million were handed to the city's police department instead of going to build the public health systems in communities devastated by the pandemic.
That's disgusting. That's not where the CARES Act money was supposed to go. There are communities, vulnerable and marginalized communities, that are not having basic needs met, while the CPD gets the newest, shiniest equipment. And that's just not right. Our demand up front right now today is to promise to have a public discussion to reassess and redistribute that money.
New President Joe Biden openly opposes defunding the police, but many hoped that with an executive order, he would at least place limits on the transfer of military equipment to local law enforcement. That hasn't happened. The Security Reform Policy Institute found that the flow of military gear has been faster under Biden than under Donald Trump.
Fundamentally, as in American cultures, we are reactionary. We don't like to deal with the root of a cause. What we need to do is think about why and how we can fix these solutions from a fundamental level. Education, mental health resources, and in general, affordable housing, public transportation. Anything that we can do to fix the foundational level, sure, it's going to take us longer. Sure, it's a longer process with the communities, lots more discussion, but that's the only way these problems will truly get solved.
The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act was approved by the House of Representatives in March, but it is not expected to be approved by the upper chamber Senate. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
We don't get it!
The Mujahideen Brigades held a military drill to show its readiness in fight against Israeli forces. The drill, named Effective Promise, was held in several parts of the enclave, simulating many defensive combat scenarios on the ground and sea. The drill also sent a clear message to the Zionist regime that the resistance will fight back the crimes committed against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds, in light of the recent clashes in the Holy City.
This drill serves as a clear message to Israel that the resistance front is ready to face any aggression. This is also a message of support to our sons in Jerusalem al-Quds, who are fighting the Zionists with all their strength.
Attending the establishment anniversary of Mujahideen brigades, leaders of Palestinian factions, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad, expressed their support to Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Jerusalem is our red line, and the Israeli regime will be held accountable for the crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Palestine, and we stand in solidarity with our sons in Jerusalem and will fight alongside them at all costs.
We are all united in the face of the Israeli regime. This is a national battle, and we are all united in protecting Jerusalem al-Quds against the Zionists. The battle is not only in Jerusalem. It's underway in every part of Palestine, and we are ready to sacrifice our lives for Palestine.
Scores of Palestinians have been injured in clashes at the Damascus Gate of the Old City of Jerusalem al-Quds, as Palestinian activists confronted hundreds of far-right and extremist Israeli settlers chanting "Death to Arabs" in their rally in the center of the occupied city.
The resistance here showed it won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes committed against the Gaza Strip and Jerusalem al-Quds, vowing to defend the Palestinian rights at all costs. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. Plead to God. The second point is that all kinds of requests, even small ones, can and should be made to God during these prayers, supplications and dhikrs. However, you should not confine your request to minor needs. There are greater needs and requests which should not be forgotten. The greatest request is divine forgiveness. You should ask God to remove signs of sin and violation from your hearts and souls. You should ask God to smooth the path of repentance for you. Another great request is divine kindness. You should ask Allah the Exalted to bestow His kindness on you. Another great request is correcting the affairs of the Islamic Ummah. You should ask Allah the Exalted to correct the affairs of all Muslims, not only the people of Iran and all Islamic countries. You should ask Him to guide humanity towards the straight path. These prayers have a good chance of being answered. They are the ones which are answered. They open the path and prepare the ground. They help us to reach great goals.
عم العباد يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 ليتك دوما قريب
Returning to God. To feel guilty, there is no need to commit sins for years. No, even a single sin counts. Sins must not be underestimated. In a hadith about underestimating sins, it is narrated that underestimation of sins is disapproved. The reason for this is that God has said, "We will forgive." For this reason, repentance and returning to God is very important. Not that committing a sin is unimportant or trivial. On the contrary, it is very dangerous. But returning to God, paying attention to God and dhikr are so important that if done honestly and correctly, then that incurable diseases will be cured. multidimensional blessings. Dua brings one closer to God. It makes knowledge effective and permanent in the heart. It strengthens faith, and this is all besides what is asked for in the dua, which is a supplication to God and is, God willing, fulfilled. So, dua has multidimensional blessings. That is why the Holy Quran repeatedly speaks about dua and supplications by pious servants of God. This is all a lesson for us.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
The debate.
Hello and warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. A prominent international rights group says that Israel's persecution of Palestinians amounts to crimes against humanity and also crimes of apartheid. Human Rights Watch cites instances of Israel's apartheid policies as restrictions on the Palestinians' movement and the seizure of their land for illegal settlement building. The rights group has urged the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute Israeli officials over the persecution of Palestinians. The court has said it will investigate war crimes by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Stay with us for a debate on that issue. Before that, let's get an update from Mona Candila Ramallah about the situation in the occupied lands and also the Palestinians' exposure to Israel's crimes of apartheid. Mona, over to you.
Well, the Palestinian Presidency welcomed the occupied support report on Israeli crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people. It urged the International Criminal Court to investigate the Israeli officials implicated in the crimes against the humanity of apartheid. It also said that this Human Rights Watch report is considered as a powerful testament to the struggle of the Palestinian people under the Israel's belligerent military occupation. But at the same time, the Israelis considered this report as claims of both perspicuous as well as false. Israeli foreign minister accused the Human Rights Watch of harboring an anti-Israeli agenda, saying that the group had sought for years to promote a boycott against Israel. Now, the Palestinians are hoping that this report would be helping them to sue Israel for the crimes, not just officials, but also Israeli settlers for the crimes against the people of Palestine.
Okay, thank you for that. Mona Candila, correspondent in Ramallah. Now, let me invite activist and commentator Brian Turrell from Malloy. Good to have you with us. Brian, some argue that Tel Aviv is taking advantage of apartheid to subjugate the Palestinians. Now, do you agree that Israel is practicing apartheid by sweeping movement restrictions of Palestinians, demolishing their homes, denying them building permits, military occupation, land expropriation, and also rejection of the residency rights?
Well, of course, yes. And I think I the issue that I take with the Human Rights Watch is that they have said recently that Israel has crossed the threshold to where these have become crimes. And I believe that's happened a long time ago, decades ago. In 2006, former President Jimmy Carter recognized that Israel was an apartheid state and got great approbation for that. So this is a long-standing thing, and it's the difference is not that Israel has somehow crossed a line, a threshold, and become an apartheid state. This is the reality that people, Palestinian people, have lived in a state of apartheid for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, we also have Mick Napier joining us out of Edinburgh. Good to have you with us, Mick. Israeli rights group B'Tselem also published a report last January, and in that it found that the Palestinians that are divided into four tiers of inferior treatment are denied the right to self-determination. Let's have your take.
Well, the report from Human Rights Watch is extremely welcome. It'll certainly shift the balance for those of us who are campaigning for the boycott of Israel. It'll shift the balance inside trade unions and church groups and mosque groups and so on, because it'll give those who are a little bit intimidated by the current Zionist censorship effort, it'll give them confidence and make it more likely that they will come out in support of boycott. Look, this is late, but it's very welcome. It's a little bit like admitting that the sun does indeed rise in the east and sets in the west. It's not the first. I mean, back in 2017, I'm sorry I missed the very first part of this conversation. Correct me if I'm repeating something. But back in 2017, Richard Falk and Virginia Tilley, on behalf of the United Nations body representing Western Europe, what people in Europe call the Middle East, came out with a report, a very comprehensive academic report, which was never challenged. The content of it was irrefutable, and it concluded that Israel was an apartheid state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, and it was suppressed by Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN. But the content was never challenged, because how can you challenge the assertion that Israel's an apartheid state when, for Palestinians, the so-called legal system is a meat processing operation where Palestinians are always guilty? Correction, 99.7% of the time they are found guilty by Israeli courts. And Jewish settlers are treated in a radically different manner by the court system. So dual legal system, Palestinian villages being unrecognized by the state, even though those villages are older than the state. I mean, when you look, if you have open eyes, you will conclude that Israel is a system of Jewish supremacy over Palestinians. It's irrefutable. I mean, I doubt very much, sir, that you'll be able to arrange a debate, because I don't see anybody coming onto a public platform and defending the proposition that Israel is not an apartheid state. They'll blare it very loudly from their media, but they cannot defend it in an open platform. And by the way, I hear that not just B'Tselem in Israel, not just Human Rights Watch, but I hear that Amnesty International will shortly follow with the same conclusion. And I think I can hear the sound of a dam breaking. Those of us who have campaigned for decades in arguing that Israel was an apartheid state, indeed, is committing a kind of slow-motion genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, we see public opinion only going one way. And we distinguish between public opinion, which is very receptive to this idea, there's no opposition, and elite and government opinions in the West, which are still trying to, still trying to keep their finger in the dike before it bursts. But burst it will, and the Human Rights Watch report is a roadmap on the way. Can I add one other point that's often lost?
Sure. But
very recently, everybody saw the legal decision, or sorry, the jury decision in the USA about George Floyd being murdered by the cop, Mr. Chauvin. Mm-hmm. That was that verdict was very likely not to have happened without the activity of millions of people in America and around the world campaigning and protesting and arguing that Black Lives Matter. It's the Palestinians who really deserve the credit for this Human Rights Watch decision. It's very slow, it's very late, but it's Palestinian resistance which has changed the mood around the world. And okay, although they can't win against Israeli weapons, they have won the battle for public opinion.
Okay. And now let me ask Brian this. Brian, isn't high time that international engagement toward applying international law and human rights change goalposts rather than considering the two-state solution as sacrosanct?
Yes, it's time that the apartheid state be looked at by the international community. It's time for Israel's nuclear weapons policy that has been off limits to speak about as well, as much taboo as apartheid. These all need to be spoken of. And it is the people, the Palestinians in the streets and the villages who have brought this about. And talk never brings justice all by itself. But we do have to begin speaking about things and calling things by their names before is an essential part of the work for justice. There's much reparation that needs to be done.
Okay, now, Mick, as an occupying force, Tel Aviv has certain responsibilities as regards the Palestinians. The regime not only ignores those functions, it also imposes fishing zone restrictions, making life harder for Palestinian fishermen in Gaza. It puts the Palestinian people's lives in further danger of the COVID pandemic, not to mention the administrative detention and you name it. Let's have your comment.
We don't have time, sir, to go through the list of crimes. We can do an A to Z. We can list the crimes against archaeology, where Israel removes any evidence when it possibly can that Palestinians have been the native people there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And we can go to Z if we wish. The crimes are inevitable given that Israel is a settler colonial project. I mean, there are harsh regimes around the world. There are murderous dictatorships in Latin America and Myanmar and elsewhere. But very few of them actually wish to remove all of the native people and replace them with incoming colonists from around the world. That's one of the ways in which Israel is unique. And it goes with the territory that you cannot achieve this by soft-soaping the Palestinians, by asking them to leave. It just can't be done except with cruelty, violence, bureaucratic means to make sure they cannot have homes that they need for their families, demolition, shoot to kill, etc., etc. It's A to Z, and you know it cannot be ended unless Zionism is ended. This pernicious creed that some people claim a real estate deal with God from 2,000, 3,000 years ago, and therefore this means that Palestinians have to be driven out of their homes. It's a whole picture, and Israel well knows that it will incur condemnation. The PA Prime Minister Shtayyeh has condemned Israel. Could he do otherwise? And probably the EU will follow suit when they see bodies and torture and so on. But this condemnation doesn't mean anything, because as long as the air bridge of weapons and money from Washington and Brussels, it has to be said, to Tel Aviv continues, they know that they can defy world opinion. But yes, the criminality is undeniable. And as I said earlier, the pro-Israel groups will not try to defend this on a level playing field, because it is simply undeniable that Israel is committing grotesque crimes against the people of Palestine. Sadly, my government is arming the criminals.
Brian, would the International Criminal Court be able to run its own investigation in an independent and appropriate way and bring Tel Aviv to justice for all the crimes it's committed?
It will have a lot of obstacles. I don't think the Israeli government is going to be compliant and participate in this, just as the United States has not been compliant about our crimes in Afghanistan and other places. We are bringing sanctions, actually, against the ICC when they threaten to prosecute Americans. So I think we're going to see that same thing. I think the issue about apartheid, though, is very different from even having the longest list of discrete crimes. Mm-hmm. You know, this is systemic. It's institutional.
Right.
This is ensconced in the laws of Israel and in their education, in their economics. It's in their, you know, it's when you say it's an apartheid state, you're not talking about the prejudices and the bigotry and the cruelty of individual people, of thugs doing violence in the street, even though that's a part of it. Haaretz newspaper yesterday said that the right-wing Jerusalem thugs are an arm of the state. It's the privatization of state violence in the streets. But we're not talking about individual crimes. We're talking about an entire system is imbued with racism. Mm-hmm.
And Mick, what do you think about the ICC? How effective could it be? I mean, if it starts an investigation, even if it's not able maybe to actually bring the perpetrators of the Tel Aviv regime to justice, could it in a way kind of contribute to the Palestinian cause?
I agree very much with your other guest. The ICC will investigate, hopefully, discrete crimes. Even the massacre of 1,000 people is some kind of individual, you know, some kind of discrete crime. The shooting dead, the mass maiming, and so on. These are a litany, but of all sorts of crimes. The thing about apartheid is, I mean, it's defined, forgive me if I've missed this at the start, it's defined by the 2002 Rome Statute of the ICC as similar to other crimes against humanity. It's considered to be a crime against humanity. Now that means that we now begin to consider Israel, and we have to shift the discourse. Israel is not a place of multiple crime scenes, crimes here, crimes there, and so on. Israel is a crime scene, and the crime is apartheid. It's as B'Tselem says, a system of Jewish supremacy over non-Jews. And the proof is indisputable. We now need to carry this argument into civil society around the world. But this decision and this characterization of Israel as an apartheid state will drive the Zionists absolutely crazy, because it definitely shifts the playing field in the direction of the Palestinian people and their supporters around the world. And condemnation of Israel clearly gets you nowhere. It can only be people who are prepared to take action, and that would mean the first governments to begin to implement sanctions against Israel, to tell the ambassadors to leave or to reduce their diplomatic presence there, because it's a lawless, it is a crime scene. And the question of the brutality and the heroism of the Palestinians, but the brutality of the settlers and the police in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, fits into this, because they're two arms on the same body. The notion that Israel's a democracy and the official state purveyors of violence will in some way rein in and control Jewish settlers who are committed, by the way, not just to driving out all Palestinians, but to taking over the Al-Aqsa Mosque as well, destroying it and replacing it with a so-called Third Temple. The idea that these are two different bodies, Israel's a democracy, you cannot be a democracy and an apartheid state. And the sinister division of labour between the settlers being protected by the military is part of that. Can I just share one thing which has really concerned me for the last 20 years since I saw it in Jerusalem? I can't understand, but it's very telling. You see groups of Jews wandering around East Jerusalem with automatic rifles slung over their shoulders. They're not wearing uniforms. They're dressed probably like me or like you. Mm-hmm. But in some mysterious way, the soldiers know that these are armed Jews and they can move around freely. A Palestinian who might look very similar, if he or she carried a screwdriver, they would be shot dead instantly. But so this apartheid system, this armed groups of Jews terrorizing Palestinians, is so organic. It's built into the system.
Now, Brian, there are also some outside players in this. Let's not focus on Washington-sponsored normalization deals among a number of Arab states and Tel Aviv, and also the so-called deal of the century and the way that they have impacted the Palestinians.
Well, yeah, of course, Washington, the arming of Israel and coming back the other way, United States police officers are being trained by Israeli police and soldiers. You know, the relationship is very close to the point where I feel as an American I'm as responsible for what's going on there as any Israeli, and feel compelled to take action on that. Yes, and the deal of the century, you know, money and weapons can buy a lot, and these connections that are, you know, my heart is not warmed by the United States brokering deals between Bahrain and Israel and Saudi Arabia and Israel and UAE and Israel. This is not does not bode well for the Palestinian people. It has not really. It's been called this deal of the century. Has been called a peace deal, but it really is. It's an armaments deal. It's a deal among gangsters to make sure, as in the words of the Raytheon CEO. Peace doesn't break out in the Middle East anytime soon. To keep it a area of growth for U.S. weapons manufacturers.
Okay. Now, Mick, I got one last question. What's behind the inaction on the part of the European claimants of human rights and international law? Are Palestinians not human beings?
Of course not. Of course not. The legislation, the international law that was passed after World War II at Nuremberg and so on, was horrified at the crimes of the Nazis against Europeans. But those crimes have been committed against Africans and Asians and Americans for hundreds and hundreds of years. They were not supposed to apply to colonial peoples opposing colonialism. And that's the reality of the situation. My own government, in fact, the Prime Minister Cameron, after the massacre of 2014, thousands of Palestinians slaughtered, he said this proves how Britain has to stand behind Israel and defend Israel's security. Why is Israel part of the Eurovision Song Contest, part of the European Football League? It is a part of Europe in the sense of a colonial projection of Europe into the Middle East, and it enjoys the support of all the big players in Europe and certainly in North America as a substitute double aircraft carrier to chastise any governments that America feels is not being sufficiently obedient. Saudis know that, the Emiratis know that, and they've chosen to align themselves with America, and therefore to do that you must throw the Palestinians under the bus. But the Palestinians are winning in a very important field, and this Human Rights Watch decision is really a tribute to their resistance, their indomitability.
Okay, and then we come to the end of this debate show. We had from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh, an activist and commentator.